A Tale of Two Cities. It's a novel written by Charles Dickens, set in London and Paris before and during the French Revolution. With well over 200 million copies sold, it ranks among the most famous works in the history of fictional literature. The novel depicts the plight of the French peasantry, demoralized by the French aristocracy in the years leading up to the revolution. The corresponding brutality demonstrated by the revolutionaries toward the former aristocrats in the early years of the revolution, and many unflattering social parallels with life in London during the same time period. It follows the lives of several protagonists through these events. And as the title suggests, being A Tale of Two Cities, the first chapter immediately establishes the era in which the novel takes place, England and France, in 1775. But one of the most famous quotes in the book is written this way. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the age of the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. And tonight, if you're joining us, we have been in the midst of a series on Sunday nights called The God Who Rescues. And as we meet the people of Israel living in Egypt at this time, I think it would be fair that they would say it was the best of times, and yet it was also the worst of times. You see, the people of Israel have been in slavery for over 400 years to a very wicked slave master called Pharaoh. One Pharaoh has taken on the other Pharaoh's slavery of the people of God, and so the people are discouraged. They're despondent. All the promises that God seemed to have made to their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, seem to be lying in tatters. All this promise about having a land flowing with milk and honey. A place called the Promised Land. A place of rest and abundance and prosperity and peace. And so at the end of chapter 2, they cry out to God. And it tells us in Exodus chapter 2 that their cry reached God himself. He heard their cry from heaven. And then last week we found out that God was working on the man that he would bring to be an instrument, to be the one who would rescue his people. Moses, as we discovered last week, marched out from the Egyptian palace as the prince of Egypt. And he thought, now is the time that I'm going to come and to rescue God's people from their slavery and from their sin. Only to be immediately rejected by the rulers. And he would have to fly as a fugitive to the land of Midian. But in Midian, for 40 years, God does business with Moses. He's humbled. He becomes a shepherd. He knows what it's like to live in isolation in the desert where his only companion was God and the animals all around him. He then learns what it's like to lead a family, because one day he's going to lead the family of God. He learns what it's like to be a shepherd, because he's going to be a shepherd of the people of God. And after 40 years, we discovered last week that Moses had learned the secret of contentment, whether he was well fed or whether he was hungry, whether he was rich or where he's poor. Moses had realized that with God, that was all that he needed. But we found out last week that that wasn't the end of the story for Moses. We find that God came to Moses and he said, Moses, you're the man. And Moses said, you know, God, you've got the wrong man. There's no way that I can march back to Egypt and tell Pharaoh that you are going to let the people that they've held in slavery for 400 years to go. There's just no way, God, you've got the wrong guy. And by the way, I'm not a very good talker. I'm not that good when it comes to upfront stuff. God, you know all about me. What about my brother Aaron? You can go and get someone else, God. And God says, no, Moses, I might use Aaron. But you're the man. You're going to be the one that will bring about this rescue. But meanwhile, back in Egypt, it's the best of times. Why? Because God is now on the move. God has come and he's spoken to Moses. Moses is now on a journey from Midian back to Egypt to come and to be the rescuer that God is calling him to meet. But the people of God back in Israel have no idea that God is on the move. A bit like in the Chronicles of Narnia, that the people had no idea at times that Aslan was on the move. And so it was the best of times, 400 years of seeming silence and God not moving and their prayers not being heard. God is now hearing, God is now answering, God is now bringing someone back to Egypt from Midian to rescue his people. But it was the worst of times. Because we're going to find as we drop down in the narrative, as God brings his rescuer right into the courtyard of where his people were, things are going to get worse before they get better. And maybe that's how you feel in your life. You say, God, when I look into your word, you have all these promises that you would never leave me or forsake me, that you wouldn't abandon me, that I'm your child and that I'm loved and I'm adopted and I'm significant and I'm secure and I'm safe in your plan and in your will. But God, when I look at my life, it looks as if it's in tatters. It looks broken. It looks totally discouraging to me and to everyone that looks at my life. And so it feels like the worst of times. And you can't see the best of times coming. It was the same for the people here. It was the worst of times and they couldn't see the best of times coming. But we need to elevate ourselves in this story. As we drop down into Exodus chapter 4 verse 18, where we'll pick up the narrative tonight. From 30,000 feet, God is on the move. God has never been more active. It's never been better for the people of God in 400 years. And we know this because it's a love story of a father coming to rescue his children. Hosea chapter 11, 1, written after the event, would talk about God's love for Israel when they were in this state of bondage and slavery. Hosea 11, 1 says this, "When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son." And so we're going to see God, the script writer, God, the actor, God, the person moving all the pieces on the chessboard into the position at exactly the right time that he would enact his rescue plan for his people. But you know that quote in Hosea 11:1 that is used to reflect on the story of God rescuing his people from Egypt? It's the same verse that is used in Matthew's gospel to describe the second Exodus when Jesus came to rescue you and me from our slavery to sin. A new Exodus in Jesus was requoted by Matthew in Hosea and then requoted in Matthew 2 verse 15. It says this, "Out of Egypt I called my son." And so here we have this story of God as a father who loves his people who are in Egyptian slavery, now coming through the person and the life of Moses to rescue his people. And then hundreds of years later, God would send his son, Jesus, out into Egypt to hide away from people who wanted to kill him and wanted to slay him. And then he would say, "Out of Egypt, Joseph, bring your son back to the land because I am now going to rescue my people." And it would be the greatest rescue. It would mean Christ going to the cross to rescue all mankind from sin. But now let's drop down with Moses into verse 18. We see the God of the second chance. Look what it says. We see the God of the second chance. Exodus chapter 4, verse 18. Moses has just had this encounter with God. In a sense, he's seen God's glory manifest in the burning bush. And so now Moses is going to go on his mission. "Then Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, 'Let me go back to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive.' Jethro said, 'Go, and I wish you well.'" Teachers and those in authority know that people underneath them are often economical with the truth. We heard this morning about some children when they go into their primary school teacher and say, "Where's your homework?" And you say, "My mum forgot to put it in my bag." Slightly economical with the truth. When perhaps someone pulls you over at the side of the road and asks you what speed you're doing, you might be tempted to be economical with the truth. And here is Moses, who's just had an encounter with a bush that doesn't burn out. He's just had an encounter with a bush that doesn't burn out and a bush that talks. He's just encountered a bush that burns and doesn't burn out, a bush that talks, and now a bush that is sending him to go back and to rescue God's people, who were at this point about 1 million people who were God's slaves in Egypt. And so now he would not tell Jethro anything about that. He just says, I want to go back to Egypt to see if any of my family are still alive. But verse 19. Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all the men who wanted to kill you are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons, put them on a donkey and started back to Egypt. And he took the staff of God in his hand. And as we journey through this first point in the narrative, we need to see the God of the second chance. Moses, no doubt, as he spent those 40 years in Midian, as he was out there alone with the sheep, as he married some Midian priest's daughter, and he had this sort of family out in this backwater part of the desert, there is no way that Moses perhaps ever thought that God could use him again like this. But yet, as we look through the whole Bible, we see a God of grace, a God of the second chance. Moses, even though you blew it, when you marched out of that palace back in Egypt and you killed that Egyptian, Moses, I can still use you again. Moses, even though you were filled with pride and arrogance and thought that you could do it in your own strength, Moses, I can use you again. Why? Because God is the God of the second chance, the third chance, the fourth chance, and the fifth chance, and even the 77th chance. Because he's a God of grace. And so verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, when you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I have given you the power to do. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says, Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go. So I will kill your firstborn son. There are many things in the Bible that I find to be a great mystery. And one of the great mysteries in this particular story is the fact that Pharaoh's heart is hardened and God knows that it will be hardened. There's an amazing mystery here between God's sovereignty, that means God being totally in control, and yet man's responsibility, that man's got to do something and they've got to take responsibility from themselves. And so God says, go back to Pharaoh, and even though you're going to talk to him, I know that his heart's going to be hardened. In a sense, God is moving in Pharaoh's heart, even though he's an unbeliever. But this is quite countercultural to the Egyptian belief about the heart. One writer called Hannah said this, another factor in God's hardening of Pharaoh's heart is that it was a reversal of Egyptian belief. Egyptians believed that when a person died, his heart was weighed in the hall of judgment. If one's heart was heavy with sin, that person was judged. A stone beetle stone was placed on the heart of a deceased person to suppress his natural tendency to confess sin, which would subject himself to judgment. This hardening of heart by the stone would result in the salvation of the deceased. However, God reversed this process in Pharaoh's case. Instead of his heart being suppressed so that he was silent about his sin and thus delivered, his heart became hardened. He confessed his sin, and his sinfully heavy heart resulted in judgment. For the Egyptians, the hardening of the heart resulted in silence, the absence of confession of sin, and therefore salvation. But God's hardening of Pharaoh's heart resulted in acknowledgement of sin and in judgment. You see, Pharaoh thinks he's a god. The Egyptians have set up society and religion the way they think is best and what is right in their own eyes. But God is saying, I'm back. I'm the actor in this story. I'm the script writer of this story. And my people will be rescued. But what's happening with Moses, verse 24? They're on their way back to Egypt. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it. "Surely you're a bridegroom of blood to me," she said. So the Lord let him alone. At that time, she said, "Bridegroom of blood," referring to circumcision. Now, in reading this week, there's some men and women who have killed hundreds of trees trying to understand what this little part of the narrative means. But I think it simply means that Moses was struggling to be a man of faith. We talked and sang about by faith tonight. By faith we see the hand of God. But Moses, as we've journeyed with him, he's struggling to see the hand of God in his life. He's struggling to obey God. And he didn't even obey God by having his own son circumcised. And it seems as if God is angry at Moses. It seems as if, in a sense, he has lost it with Moses. If his grace has run out with Moses. But yet his godly wife steps in. And she circumcises her firstborn son. It is likely here that Moses was so unwell, being under the judgment of God, that he hasn't the ability to do this. And so Sapphira steps in and saves the day. Because God is the God of the second chance, the third chance, and the 77th chance. And so Moses is rescued by his godly wife. And so he continues to speak in verse 27. The Lord said to Aaron, his brother, "Go into the desert to meet Moses." So he met Moses at the mountain of God and kissed him. Then Moses told Aaron everything the Lord had sent him to say, and also about the miraculous signs he had commanded him to perform. Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. He also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. They couldn't believe that God still cared for them. In fact, for over hundreds of years, it seems to be as if God has been silent. Perhaps many of the people of God were angry at God. Many people talk to me personally and pastorally that at times they feel angry with God. Maybe you felt like that. Maybe you feel like that tonight. When you look at your circumstance, when you review your times of prayer, when you review the last number of years and months and you see that things seem to go from bad to worse, it doesn't seem like the best of times at all. It just seems like the worst of times. And it seems as if God is so distant tonight. And yet here, in this next part of the narrative, God is back and he's speaking intimately to his people. But what have the people of God learned over 400 years of slavery? They've learned to trust in God. It's amazing because the more Pharaoh tried to wipe out his people, the more they continued to grow and to increase in number and to multiply, even though they tried to kill all the firstborn sons, even though they tried to suppress them with labor from morning to late night. God continued to multiply and bless his people in affliction, difficulty. And Peter would write to Christians who were struggling in Asia Minor. He said this to them, 1 Peter 1 verse 6. "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have to suffer grief and all kinds of various trials. These have come so that your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise and in glory and honor when Jesus Christ reveals." You see, God does something with you and me tonight, his people, in the fire and in the difficulty and in the affliction that he can do on the mountaintop. It seems to be everywhere I go, that's people's testimony. One person told me not so long ago that they go to another church. This particular lady was married and they had a little son who was only about a year and a half old. And her husband died of cancer about a year later. Both of them, as a family, had been accepted to go to foreign missions to serve God. And so this lady's never remarried, and it was about a number of months ago, I was talking to her and I asked this particular lady, I said, how have you reconciled the love of God, the promises of God's word, with what you've suffered in your life? And she turned to me in a scene that I don't think I'll ever forget the rest of my life. And she said to me, Johnny, I would never change it. I would never change it. And there I am looking into this eyes of this lady who's one of the most godly ladies that I know. And there she's a living testimony of someone who's living in the fire. Someone who's lived in the affliction. Someone who's lived in the difficult. Somebody who's wrestled with God probably morning, noon and night for 30 years as to why. And yet there she is. She says she loves God with all of her heart. And she would never change it. Why? Because she's been a living testimony. In this, she has greatly rejoiced. Even though she has suffered grief in many different trials, she has proved her faith. It's come forth as gold. C.H. Spurgeon, that great historical figure and Baptist preacher, said this, "Fiery trials make golden Christians." He then would go on to say in that sermon that God doesn't seem to save his children from the fire. He seems to save them in the fire. We think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, those three Hebrew boys in the midst of those flames when the guards have burned up and the whole world is against them. Babylon's against them. The culture's against them. They won't bow down to the gods of their society. And then in the midst of the flames, it wasn't outside the flames, it wasn't on the journey to the flames, it was in the middle of the fiery furnace that a fourth person, one whom Nebuchadnezzar described as one as the son of the gods, I believe it was the pre-incarnate Christ, that means an appearance of Christ before he came to earth, the Jesus of Nazareth, who came to save his children in the fire. But we've also discovered in this series that when you read Hebrews chapter 11 and you see the heroes of the faith, that some people aren't rescued on this earth. In fact, it says at the end of that great chapter that some went about in sheepskins and in goatskins and destitute and abandoned and forsaken, and some had their heads chopped off. And it says these were men and women of whom the world is not worthy of. And they didn't receive what was promised on this earth because they were looking forward to the city whose architect and builder was God. You see, they were looking to their citizenship in heaven. They knew that they would find rescue there. And so whether God rescues us on this earth or whether he will always rescue us for all eternity, he's the God of rescue. But secondly, he's the God who speaks. He's the God who speaks. Look at chapter 5. He's the God who speaks. I wonder if you've ever dreaded a particular meeting or interview. You say, tell me about it, Johnny. You don't realize who I've got to go and see in the morning. My weekly meeting with that boss who have got a dartboard with their picture up and I throw darts at it. Metaphorically, of course. This was a meeting that Aaron and Moses were dreading. Both of them are now in their 80s. Both of them are brothers. Moses has been out of this sort of leadership business for an awful long time. And here he is as an 80-year-old on a journey now to go and speak to Pharaoh. So let's drop down in the text. Chapter 5, verse 1, afterward, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, now, I am kind of amazed how Moses isn't killed by this time. Perhaps he's able to pull a few strings from folks that he knew from 40 years ago when he was one of the princes of Egypt. But we must remember, this guy's a fugitive. He was on the run. The Egyptian police were after him. But he manages somehow to get into the very courtyard where Pharaoh is. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, so that they may hold a festival to me in the desert. Pharaoh said, who is the Lord, or who is Yahweh, that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go. Now, think what this is like for Pharaoh. He's got two 80-year-old men standing in his courtyard. One of them's a fugitive. One of them who has got charges of murder against him in Egyptian history and in the courts. And some guy called Aaron, who he's never really heard of before in his life. Two sort of scrappy men standing in front of him saying, by the way, you know your workforce of 1 million people? Sort of time to move them on. And Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord? I've never heard of this guy." But he will get to know him very soon. Verse 3. Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let us take a 3-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work." And then Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now numerous and you're stopping them from working." That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and foremen in charge of the people. "You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw. But require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They are lazy. That is why they're crying out. Let us go and sacrifice to our God. Make them work harder for the men so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." I'm sure you've heard of the phrase, "out of the frying pan and into the fire." So reads the title of a chapter in J.R.R. Tolkien's wonderful adventure story, The Hobbit. The chapter describes how Bilbo Baggins and his friends, 13 dwarves and the old wizard Gandalf, escaped from extreme peril, only to find themselves in a worse predicament. The intrepid adventurers had been trawling and traveling through the tunnels under the misty mountains when they were beset by goblins. And after a brief battle, they escaped by the narrowest of margin. Bilbo himself was the last one out of the mountain, as he always is. Stuck in the stone doorway that led to freedom, he only managed to wriggle free, losing all of his buttons in the process. But when they got out of the mountain, as they hurried into the forest, they're surrounded by hungry wolves. They then climbed to the top of some trees where goblins tried to burn them down with the flames licking their feet. Out of the frying pan into the fire. What an aptly named chapter. And that is the people of God's experience here. God is now intervening in the story, but things seem to be getting worse. And in your life, it perhaps seems as if things are going from bad to worse. You come out of the frying pan into an even hotter and more extreme circumstance. Look at verse 10. Then the slave drivers and the foreman went out and said to the people, "This is what Pharaoh says, I will not give you any more straw. Go and get your own straw wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced at all." So the people scattered all over Egypt to gather stubble to use for straw. The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, "Complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you had straw." The Israelite foremen appointed by Pharaoh's slave drivers were beaten and were asked, "Why didn't you meet your quota of bricks yesterday, today, or as before?" Now think about what this is like for the people. One writer called Howard Voss said this: "They worked out in the hot Egyptian sun all day, often in temperatures over 100 degrees. Driven to optimum production by their taskmasters, they had no hats to protect their heads, wore nothing but a brief kilt or apron on their bodies. A wealthy Egyptian father talked with his son about the conditions of these Hebrews. He observed that their kidneys suffer because they're out in the sun with no clothes on. Their hands are torn to ribbons by the cruel work, and they have to knead all sorts of muck. Certainly no one stood by to give the workers a drink every few minutes. It does not take much imagination to conclude that the severe rigor imposed on the Hebrews resulted in many of them dying of dehydration, heat prostration, heat stroke, and the like." Think what this is like. You're there out working for God. And there you see people starting to die around you. Because things are going from worse to the most extreme versions of worse. God, what are you doing? You see, it was the best of times, but it was really the worst of times for the people. Verse 19, the Israelite foreman realized they were in trouble when they were told, "You're not to reduce the number of bricks required of you each day." When they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them. Now, if I was Moses and Aaron, this would not be a sort of meeting I would have been looking forward to either. And they come out of their meeting with Pharaoh, verse 21,
And they said, perhaps from a distance, before they even got right up to their faces,
may the Lord look upon you and judge you. You have made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us. You can imagine these four men, these Hebrew four men, coming to Moses and Aaron saying, if you boys hadn't come back here, we wouldn't be in this situation. If you hadn't put your big nose in it, if you hadn't started talking such big talk and making us believe some ridiculous story that God is coming to rescue us because we are dying by the day out here. It's the worst of times.
But there wouldn't just be the God of the second chance. There wouldn't just be the God who speaks, but then there would be the God who delivers. Chapter 5, verse 22. Moses returned to the Lord and said, oh Lord, why? Why have you brought trouble upon this people? Is this why you sent me?
Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble upon this people, and you have not rescued your people at all.
Then the Lord said to Moses, now you will see. Someone once said, God is never, never early, but he's never, never late. And he says, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of the country. God also said to Moses, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. That means God El Shaddai. But my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan where they lived as aliens. Moreover, I've heard their groaning of the Israelites whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. El Shaddai has appeared. That means God Almighty. God our warrior. There's a lovely promise that God gave to Abraham, that whoever will come against you is basically picking a fight with me. That was the undoing of Goliath. Goliath didn't realize that it wasn't just little David standing before him, but there was an unseen warrior called Yahweh who had turned up at the scene when he started to curse the name of God. And this is exactly what's happening. Pharaoh's picked not a fight with Moses, he's picked a fight with God. And so God El Shaddai is now ready to come and to remember all of his promises. He remembers his people. But 1,500 years later than this story, the same compassion moved God to send his son to be our rescuer. He saw the people he loved were enslaved by the powers of sin, and he remembered his unbreakable promise of salvation. And Zechariah the priest recorded these words in Luke chapter 1 verse 68. Praise be to the Lord God of Israel, because he has come and he has rescued his people. He has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. As he said through his holy prophets long ago, salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show mercy to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath he swore to our father Abraham, to rescue us from the hand of our enemies. You see, the whole story of the Bible is a love story of the God who comes to rescue his children. Then verse 6 of Exodus chapter 6. Therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from slavery. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people. I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hands to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and to give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. What difference does it make when I am steps into your life? What difference in our lives does it make when we stop focusing on the issue and on the problem and we start moving our focus and our attention to God.
He says, Moses, you're not going to find the strength in you. You're not going to find the strength in the people of Israel. You're not going to find the strength in Aaron, though he might be a good communicator. Listen to the language. I will bring you out. I will set you free. I will redeem you. I will take you as my own people. I will be your God. I will bring you to the land. I will give it to you. It's all about God. And I believe God is asking each one of us tonight to have a God-centered vision, whatever your situation is tonight. You see, when Moses and Aaron get a God-centered vision and they have an encounter with God, their situation changes. Moses is a fugitive man. Moses is a man who lacks courage. But here he is standing in front of Pharaoh and he's saying, let your 1 million slaves go. Why? Because he's filled with God. Moses, verse 9, returned to the Israelites. But they did not listen to him. You can understand that. Because of their discouragement and cruel bondage. Then the Lord said to Moses, go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go out of the country. But Moses, verse 12, said to the Lord, if the Israelites will not listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me since I speak with faltering lips? And then we skip down to verse 26. It was at this time Aaron and Moses, to whom the Lord said, bring the Israelites out of Egypt by their divisions. They were the ones who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. It was the same Moses and Aaron. So the Israelites won't listen to Moses and Aaron any longer. Even though God has his rescuers in the center of Egypt, in the Egyptian household, and in the very courtyard of Pharaoh himself. It was the best of times. But yet for God's people, it seemed to be the worst of times. Earlier on, we noted that Bilbo Baggins and his friends are up in the trees, having been thrown out of the frying pan into the fire. We left little poor Bilbo and his friends about to be roasted by goblins. Fortunately, they managed to escape. At the last possible moment, giant eagles swooped down and carried them away to safety. And listen to what Moses would say about what will happen in Exodus chapter 19, verse 4. He reflects on their time in Egypt when they've been rescued. He says, you yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. You see, the one who rescues is the one who comes on eagle's wings. He's the only one that can rescue. And so tonight I would urge you to come to Christ. Whether you're a Christian or non-Christian, maybe as a non-Christian coming to him for the first time, as a Christian coming to him afresh and saying, God, in the midst of this situation, it seems like the worst of times. Will you give me the faith to realize you're the God of rescue, whether it's in this earth or it's in the world yet to come? Would you lift me tonight on eagle's wings? Even if it's to remain in the storm, would you give me the strength to carry me through this storm?